Judge Jessen, Judge Werke, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on June 9th, 2020, and our arguments via WebEx. Thank you very much for participating in this new virtual world that we are all in. We have our panelists, Judge Werke, myself, and Judge Hooten. Judge Hooten, unfortunately, is ill, so she will be listening to the recordings of our arguments this morning, and after she listens to the full arguments, then the panel will conference in. We do have three oral arguments before us this morning. As I think you both know, each side will have 15 minutes for their argument, just as if we were in the physical courtroom, and an additional 5 minutes for a rebuttal for the appellant's lawyers. We will have our marshal holding up the time, but if you experience any difficulties, if your screen freezes or you have difficulties, we will readjust the time. We want to make sure everyone has adequate time and that no technological difficulties get in our way. So with that, our first case is A19-1927, Gary Allen Jensen versus the matter of the 1985 Ferrari. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mr. Kendall, may it please the court. I am James Ventura, and I'm representing Gary Jensen in this matter of the forfeiture of his 1985 Ferrari. The factual history is that my client was arrested and charged on August 4th with a driving while impaired offense, second degree of gross misdemeanor. In addition, he was charged with a driver's license violation of consuming alcohol at a time when he had a B card. He was not convicted of those offenses. He was instead convicted of a third degree, which is not a forfeitable offense. The notice my client received is Exhibit 5 in the trial exhibit. It's a standard notice of seizure and intent to forfeit vehicle. It states impaired driving and then references Minnesota Statute 1698.63. Other options that the officer or trooper in this case could have used were off-highway vehicle or controlled substance. The same form is used for all. As an alternative, the forfeiting agency, that being the State Patrol, and the law enforcement agency could have filed a complaint. They could have put in an answer to the forfeiture complaint that we'd put in. They could have responded, and they could have argued that the forfeiture was based on something other than the criminal act and soon to be criminal conviction, or at least in the minds of the state. While the case was pending, I became aware of the United States versus Timms. It's actually Indiana versus Timms at the United States Supreme Court. So I amended on January 31st, 2019, because I anticipated that decision was going to come up. We were scheduled for a trial, and I'd asked that the trial not be heard promptly. My client waived his right to a speedy trial. That was granted. Timms was then decided on February 20th, and we were scheduled for an appearance in April where my client entered a guilty plea to the reduced third degree offense, not a forfeitable offense or designated. And at that time, my client was set on for sentencing that occurred in May.
So, counsel, if I can cut to the chase a bit here on the Timms case, how is the Timms case inconsistent with our Minnesota precedent?
Well, Minnesota precedent in the past has never really done an analysis, which is why I prepared Exhibit 8 to the court. That was an analysis of the different criminal statutes and the maximum fines for each. Previously, unfortunately, our courts have said that they did this analysis, but I've never seen it. Never, ever, ever. And the most important thing about Timms is in a unanimous decision, not 5-4, 6-3, unanimous, they found that the United States Constitution applied to the states and that the forfeiture in Timms was unconstitutional as an excessive fine. Now, bear in mind, Timms was charged with and convicted of a felony of distributing heroin. He transported heroin in that motor vehicle. He drove it around in it for sale. The maximum fine was $10,000. The actual fine was considerably less. It was, off the top of my head, I want to say $1,300. I can find it. I have it later in my argument.
So I just want to make sure. So you're not saying that the legal analysis under Timms would be different than what has been, you know, I think using, is it the solemn factors that Minnesota courts have done, but more just factually, this is very different from this case. Am I hearing you correctly?
Well, the first thing is that we're supposed to, the courts and this court, compare the amount of forfeiture to the gravity of defendant's offense. That's what the Supreme Court has said. Unfortunately, our courts have failed to do so previously. The gravity of the offense, bearing in mind that Timms was a felony level offense. Mr. Jensen was only a gross misdemeanor. If you look at Exhibit 8, the potential fines for felonies is significantly higher than a gross misdemeanor with a maximum of only $3,000. And so it's my opinion that the Timms reset the scale for us and made it easier.
Do we just look at ultimately at what he was convicted of, which was the third degree misdemeanor? Do we not take into consideration his criminal history as it relates to the DUI statutes?
Well, I can read it again, but it just says compare the amount of the forfeiture to the gravity of the defendant's offense. I don't see anywhere where it says, hey, and look and see how bad he's been in the past. If my client was truly bad in the past, this would have been a felony. It wasn't. He wasn't.
I turned your attention. I started to ask a question and I forgot that I was muted, but you were going through the timeline. And what concerns me about the timeline, the way you rolled it out, you're arguing due process, but it seems to me that based on your own statement of the timeline, and I'm sorry, this is my home phone, the time that it takes for, I'm going to mute and then I'll wait until the next.
So if I may, Mr. Ventura, looking at those other factors, one of the ones I wanted to ask you about was the sentences imposed on other criminals in Minnesota. I think that's the factor.
Yes.
Our courts say to look at. So I wanted to ask both of you. So do we look at the sentence imposed, you know, overall, or do we just look at the sentence that's imposed here? I mean, in other words, do we look at just the panoply of DUI laws, or do we just say, okay, let's just focus on what he was convicted of?
Well, I think when you look at the gravity of the offense, the fine imposed by the trial judge who's in the best decision-making spot to determine the gravity of it would control. But even if he got the maximum fine of $3,000, three times that would be $9,000, four times that, which would be maximum bail, would be $12,000. I would argue that in the past, in Bajaka Chijian, the Ninth Circuit said, gee, if the appellant would have appealed the $15,000 fine on his felony, that being the forfeiture, because we're equating a fine to forfeiture, forfeiture to fine. They're both punishment, and they're both done based on the criminal act. And in that instance, the court said, they wouldn't have upheld the $15,000, but they certainly refused the government's efforts to get the $300,000+. So that's, I think, very important, $357,144. And the Supreme Court agreed. Had he appealed, the $15,000 wouldn't have even been forfeited. He was fined $5,000, so that's three times. Timms was fined only $1,200 and $1,203. But the potential maximum was $10,000. And the forfeiture of a $42,000 vehicle was excessive. I think it gives us some guidance. I'd ask you to consider instead, can you name or show me any court of appeals or Supreme Court case in which the forfeiture of an automobile in a driving while impaired offense was deemed to be an excessive fine? I couldn't find one, which tells me that the analysis has never been done, since in no appellate case I've ever reviewed has anyone mentioned what the fines were for other charges. There was no chart. There's some lip service to, gee, other states do it too. My mother used to say, and if other kids ran off the cliff, would you do it too? Let's use our noggins on this and realize that this is an excessive fine. The reason that I know it's an excessive fine is the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul have stopped doing forfeitures unless it's a felony. Why? gravity of the offense. Compare the amount of forfeiture to the gravity of defendant's offense. They've already predetermined that. The state patrol has decided that that doesn't apply to them. The state patrol, and if you can check, it's a public record, and the last one I have is the state auditor's report, and it's effective for the year 2018. There were 3,668 DWI forfeitures. Only 7% of those had a value of $5,000 or more. The state patrol leads all enforcement agencies in a total of 1,586 forfeitures.
I don't know if it's appropriate for me to object here, but none of this is in the record.
Mr. Kendall, you can point that out during your argument.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Ventura.
Yep, I'm just quoting from a public record that's easily accessible to everyone. It's a state auditor's report. And in it, the last year that they have a record of was 2018. The highest value vehicle was $30,500. It was a 2015 BMW X5.
If I may, I just want to, Mr. Ventura, I understand what you're saying here. I want to kind of move to the due process, your due process claim for just a moment. And just tell us why the recent decision in Olson versus the forfeiture of that 1999 Lexus, where they found the forfeiture statute didn't violate procedural due process as to the owner arrestee. You know, why doesn't that resolve the issues before us here? Why is this case different?
Well, because similar to Helen, my client was in the position where his excessive fine argument was never decided. In fact, it really wasn't truly decided by the trial court.
So when you're talking about, I mean, you make a procedural due process claim, but you're really relying on the excessive fine.
Yes, that was the procedural due process that it should have been set aside. And I know this.
My question that I was trying to ask you before my home phone went off, that was my question, because it appeared that you were arguing the timetable of it, that you didn't have due process as far as a meaningful review. So that's not what you're getting at. You're getting at, again, the excessive fine. Just for my clarification.
Meaningful of that excessive fine, correct. The excessive fine is separate and apart from the forfeiture. It's another version, just like the ignition interlock exception. And both of those together tell me that the legislature has no intention of forfeiting vehicles so long as they can put a person behind the wheel and have a valid license that's governed by the ignition interlock.
Aren't those many of the procedural safeguards that are referenced by Olson to alleviate potential hardship?
Well, at the time of Olson, it wasn't in existence. The ignition interlock exception only came into play while this case was pending. I say that it started on July 1st because it was part of a budget bill. The prosecuting authority argues that it didn't take place till August 1st. But in either event, I argued it to the judge and she didn't issue a decision until October, and she should have addressed that and said, this applies. Now, it's interesting that my opponent thinks that I should file a motion, but when I look at the statute, there's no word motion in it. And more importantly, had I filed a motion, that would have delayed the trial, delayed the inevitable, having a hearing. And so I opted to have that heard at the trial as a motion, which isn't a motion, but rather a defense to forfeiture. And I know that it's his argument that, well, hey, you have to put ignition interlock on the vehicle. Well, the absurdity of that is quite simple. Motorboat, motorcycle, ATV. None of those vehicles could have ignition interlock on them. The statute doesn't say put ignition interlock on the vehicle you want returned. The statute says be enrolled in it, and my client was. And that's why we submitted that proof at trial. The argument that I have about due process also exists in the notice. The notice saying impaired driving doesn't tell me that you're going to use my client's civil driver's license privilege to base the forfeiture. Because remember, the courts have equated forfeiture to fine. It's truly quasi-criminal. They've stated that forfeiture is a penalty. It's not anything other than that. If he wasn't convicted, which he wasn't of a forfeitable offense, it should have been returned. From my perspective and my argument, which is different than a case raised by my opponent, an unpublished Scheffler. In Scheffler, he never argued that the notice was improper. I'm saying that the notice is absolutely improper. Nowhere when I look at this does it say, oh, and because you had a driver's license restriction and drove in violation of it, you're losing your car. That also brings up the idea of notice. So recently the court has held that if a person loses their driving privilege, they must receive the notice and be aware of it. My client, if you're arguing, well, the B card should take away. First, that's a civil matter with civil penalties and civil rights, meaning no trial to a jury, no proof beyond reasonable doubt, rather only preponderance of the evidence. And it's a summary hearing, basically. There's one witness, two sometimes, hardly any due process to it. The burden of proof is minimal. You cannot use that to base the forfeiture of a person's property. It's different to take a person's privilege because our courts and our state have long held that your driver's license is a privilege, not a right. You have to abide by the rules or you don't have one. But in this instance, the state patrol and the forfeiting agency, who are going to be the beneficiaries of all the funds, have decided that they think that the driver's license loss because of a violation of a B card, which, by the way, you'd ask, well, did he get notice that he was revoked? Of course not. The way the statute's written is, if you drink alcohol, you're revoked. The consumption of alcohol causes the loss of the privilege. But where's the notice? When would a person know? It's ridiculous. You may try and base loss of privileges for that, but you cannot base the theft of property.
Thank you, Mr. Ventura. You'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Kendall.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm David Kendall, representing the State Patrol in this matter. I want to first address counsel's argument about the sufficiency of notice. So I'm sure the court has seen a copy of the notice. What it says is that the forfeiture is based on impaired driving, and it cites to Minnesota Statute 169A.63. So the entire title of the chapter 169A is driving while impaired, and that chapter includes all of the criminal consequences and all of the civil driver's license revocation consequences and all of the civil forfeiture consequences all appear within that statute 169A, or within that chapter. And then within 169A.63, the forfeiture section, the plain language of that statute makes clear that the forfeiture may be based upon a conviction for a designated criminal offense or for a designated driver's license revocation. This statute has never been found unconstitutional, remains good law. In this case, the driver was convicted of a designated offense, and counsel seems to want you to ignore that fact, but a designated offense may include a second degree conviction, or it may include a conviction for any level of offense for DUI while you have the restriction on your driver's license saying, which is commonly called a B card, saying any use of alcohol invalidates the license. So he was convicted of a DWI offense while he had that restriction on his driver's license. So he was convicted of a designated criminal offense under the statute. So this is not the case where the individual was not convicted of a designated offense. I think it's a red herring for counsel to suggest that they are the same. They are clearly not. Moving on from that, he was also subject to a designated license revocation. He filed an implied consent challenge to his license revocation. That license, in this case, related to this case, that license revocation was sustained. That license revocation remains on his driving record, and that is a second independent basis for forfeiture. Now, counsel seems to argue that he had insufficient notice of that, and he assumed when he looked at that notice that the conviction would only be based on a designated offense. Well, first of all, there was a conviction for a designated offense. And second of all, the notice doesn't say that. The notice says 169A.63. All you have to do is look at 169A.63 and you can see that the conviction may be based on either the designated conviction or a criminal offense or the designated license revocation. In this case, we have both. So
Kendall, if I may kind of move you, because I think I understand what you're saying on that point, the statutory interpretation, but to whether this forfeiture is an unconstitutional excessive fine. And to me, the kind of big issue here when we're looking at, is it grossly disproportional, as Mr. Ventura was saying, the gravity of the offense and the harshness of the penalty. I mean, when you're looking at something that gets you home monitoring and a $900 fine versus, you know, forfeiture of a car worth at least under, I know the parties dispute this, but, you know, $45,000. I mean, how, and when the offense is a gross misdemeanor, I just find that troubling. So I'd like to hear your perspective. Am I looking at the wrong factors here? Do I need to look at this more broadly? Or is this the sort of thing should just give deference to the district court?
Your Honor, you do need to look at it more broadly, I would say, yes. The Solem factors, first of all, this has been analyzed extensively in Minnesota cases. I mean, counsel argues that it's not been addressed. There's numerous Minnesota cases upholding forfeitures and going through this analysis. And the Timms case did not change anything. That says that the excessive fines clause applies to states handling civil in rem forfeitures. Minnesota has held that since the 1990s. So this is not a new situation. As far as the factors for the court to look at, which I know is what you're interested in, the Minnesota Supreme Court has utilized the Solem factors, and they are not based solely upon the maximum fine for this offense, which is $3,000.
What authority are you relying on when you say the Minnesota Supreme Court has adopted that?
That was in Miller versus 1-2001 Pontiac Aztec.
Thank you.
That was 655 Northwest 2nd 12. I believe the court used the Solem factors in that case.
I think Judge Warkey's question went just not where the court adopted the factors, but where they said, look, when we look at the gravity of the offense, we look more broadly, as you suggest, than the offense that's the basis of the forfeiture.
Yes. So the Solem factors utilized by Minnesota courts in the past include the gravity of the offense as compared to the harshness of the forfeiture. And I would submit to the court on that factor, this is not a harsh situation. This is an individual with five DWIs. This is a serious offense. The fact that he didn't get four within 10, so that it was a felony, you know, it happens to be outside that look back period. It does not mean that it's not a serious offense in the eyes of the public. And also I look at the vehicle, because this is a recreational vehicle. It's not his work vehicle. This is a two seat, no trunk, rear wheel drive vehicle. He's not going to be losing the use of a vehicle he utilizes to carry out his livelihood, things of that nature. But moving on from that, the second factor is fines for other crimes in this state. And that's where the court can look at the maximum fines in felony offenses, which range up to $50,000.
But what authority do you have that says that we can look at sentences for felonies when what we are talking about is gross misdemeanor here?
That's in the Solem factors, Your Honor.
Well, I mean, I understand that the factors say that we can look at sentences imposed, but I thought it was the same crime in Minnesota. I mean, you're more familiar with this area of the law than I am, so help me understand.
Well, to the extent that it's understandable, the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota courts have adopted the Solem factors, which, in order to determine whether it's a disproportionate fine, you look first at the gravity of the offense compared to the harshness, and then at the fines for other crimes in the same jurisdiction. So that includes not just DUI crimes, although you could certainly look at the maximum fine for a felony DUI, but it includes all crimes, and counsel has prepared this exhibit showing the fines for all crimes in.
But Mr. Kendall, are you asserting then that there is no monetary limit in a forfeiture situation? I mean, I know we're talking a lot of money now, but if it was higher than that, is there any limit? Is there any ceiling?
Yes, I think there is, and I think it was clear in the Bajikagian case that counsel cited to You know, that was a case where these factors were not in play. The purpose of DUI forfeiture in part is to remove the instrumentality of the crime from the hands of the offender and prevent recidivism. You can't commit a DUI offense without a vehicle. So what in this Bajikagian case, the offense was failure to declare the money on a customs form. The money was not proceeds from a crime. He had not obtained the money illegally. The money was not the instrumentality of the crime. He was not using the money to commit the crime. The sole crime was filling out the form incorrectly or failing to fill out the form. I think anyone would agree that forfeiture of $357,000 for failure to fill out a form correctly would clearly be grossly disproportionate. So I'm not saying that there is never a line. There is clearly a line. I'm just submitting to the court that this particular forfeiture of this vehicle does not cross that line. And I guess if the court doesn't have any further questions, I'll quickly address the whole stay argument. It's not clear to me if counsel is still pursuing that, but first of all, ignition interlock has been around for many years. I'm not sure if he's arguing that ignition interlock was not around or just the stay of forfeiture while on interlock. That is a new statute as of last year. But counsel did not ask the trial court to apply that statute. He asked the trial court to rule, and now he's apparently asking the Court of Appeals to stay the forfeiture after the trial court has ruled. I'm not sure what the procedural posture is, but I don't think that's possible.
And I'm just not following your argument here when I looked at your brief, because the district court order clearly addressed that. So, however, I mean, perhaps he didn't bring the right motion, but we don't address things that aren't brought to the district judge's attention, but the judge obviously addressed it when I read the order. Is that incorrect?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. So,
no, is it correct or incorrect? I mean, did the district court address this issue?
The district court did address the issue.
So why isn't that properly before?
I'm sorry. I may be misunderstanding your question. The district court did not address the issue in terms of this is not properly before the Court of Appeals.
I'm just pulling out the district court order here. Where I read it, that it talks about the, sorry if it just takes me a moment, it talks about the retroactivity of the new statute and the stay.
Well, I guess what I should say, Your Honor, is the district court did address the issue. The district court did not find that the stay was appropriate. And so my question or confusion is, if counsel didn't ask for the stay in the first place, which he didn't, he asked the court to rule. After the court ruled against him, how can you then ask for the stay? That's the part I don't understand. The court did address the issue and I guess declined to stay the forfeiture because he hadn't really fully flushed out the issue or actually made a formal motion for stay. He just, in his post-trial arguments, argued that the statute exists that could allow for a stay, but he didn't ask the court not to rule. He asked the court to rule.
But it doesn't make any difference to us, does it, in terms of when the statute became effective, whether it was August 1, which most are, or July 1? What difference would that make why this case was pending over both periods of time?
No, I don't think it makes any difference to you. And I do think the district court addressed it as fully as the district court could have under the issues that was presented to the district court. Counsel just kind of raised the issue that this statute existed and the court acknowledged that it exists, but counsel also asked her to rule and not to stay, so she ruled.
Could you touch on one of the last arguments of Mr. Ventura had to do with whether the phrase refers to the vehicle that was the vehicle that we're talking about, the Ferrari here. Is it specifically applying to that as far as the ignition interlock? I'm just curious as to what your position is.
Yes, Your Honor, my position is that the statute applies to the vehicle being held for forfeiture. So there are a large number of statutory provisions in that new statute that talk about the vehicle may be, the forfeiture may be stated, the vehicle may be released if the driver pays the expenses on the vehicle and if the tow yard allows the ignition interlock provider into the tow yard to install interlock on the vehicle, and various other steps have to occur on this vehicle before it may be released. So I don't think there's any merit to the argument that if anyone gets ignition interlock on any vehicle, then all of their forfeitures are immediately stayed. They have to follow the procedures in the statute to get the forfeiture of a particular vehicle stayed by following the procedures on that particular vehicle. And, you know, finally, I would just note on that, counsel and his client did not move for any kind of stay pending appeal. So I think this court can certainly overrule the trial court on the merits if it believes the trial court was incorrect, but there has been no stay pending appeal. There's been no motion in the trial court. There's been no supersedious bond. So I don't believe it's possible at this point to argue that the forfeiture can now be stayed. Yes, the court to rule, the court, the district court, and the district court did rule, and he did not move for stay of that ruling pending appeal. I understand he's appealed it, and so if the if this court overrules the trial court on the merits, then so be it. But just asking the Court of Appeals to stay a previous ruling by the trial court, I don't think is procedurally possible. So I would ask this court to deny that motion to the extent it's pending before this court.
Thank you, Mr. Kindle.
Thank
you. Any other questions, Judge Warkey?
Yes, I mean, no, I have no other questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Then Mr. Ventura, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. As I addressed in my brief, I think it's crystal clear that the Solem factors, bear in mind, Solem was an excessive jail. It was a punishment. It was how much prison the guy got. It is not an excessive fine. It is not a forfeiture. Solem was decided 10 years before Austin. 10 years to the day, interestingly enough. When I first looked at it, I thought, oh my gosh, they decided these the same day. No, one was 10 years before the other. Austin did not use the Solem factors. The Supreme Court of the United States does not believe that the Solem factors are the determination. Just look at Bajakistan.
But our Supreme Court has used the Solem factors, and that isn't that bind? Tell us why that would not be binding on us here.
Well, because they're wrong, once again, just like the analysis of, hey, it's a DWI, therefore, let's forfeit any and all cars. You can't do it. We're giving lip service to the actual law as handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. The 9-0 decision of Timms made it crystal clear. If it wasn't clear before, it should be now. Look to see the seriousness of the offense. In a felony that was heroin transported in the vehicle, you couldn't forfeit a vehicle 4 times the maximum fine. That is a clarity that our state has lacked. As I said, no decision ever from an appellate court that I could find finding an excessive DWI fine forfeiture. I couldn't find one. How could that be? There is no such thing as an excessive fine in a forfeiture. That's unrealistic. That can only exist in a vacuum. And this vacuum needs to be broken. We need to let the light of day come in and actually look at and truly analyze the factors that the Supreme Court has told us apply, not the factors that our Supreme Court has used in the past. It's a little bit like the exception that in the past, Minnesota after McNeely still thought, well, you can keep doing this. You don't need no stinking warrant. We've been wrong. It's time we realize, as the forfeitures, we've been wrong. The fact that you can't find one for me tells me that this is the improper analysis. It is not what the federal courts have set out. And I want to make it crystal clear. That's why it's in the brief, and I'm arguing it again. Now, the interesting thing for us to talk about is the purpose. And I know the state says, gosh, this is important. This is vital that we do it this way because we have important, very important safeguards. But the safeguards that they have are really not the safeguards we should be concerned with. First, the ignition interlock exception has taken hold. that exception set forth, and the statute doesn't say you bring a motion. Had I filed for a motion, it would have delayed the trial. My intent was to have the whole matter heard at one time. We would have had a quicker hearing had the prosecuting authority not removed a judge that had already been set to hear it. So that moved it back. But the reality is that the statute doesn't require a motion and a motion fee be paid. It says that it can happen. The trial court totally failed us in that they determined that it's not an excessive fine, but can you please find in the order you set the value of the vehicle? Because I can't find it. You can't tell me you did an excessive fine analysis without setting what is the value of the vehicle. You can't tell me that I should have then filed a motion. First, the trial court was divested of jurisdiction once I filed the notice of appeal. Divested. And I can't ask this court to do it because the trial court never set value. So what bond do I post? Mr. Kendall and I have not been able to agree on the value of the vehicle. That's why it was submitted to the trial court for its decision. I do note in the state's brief, in Mr. Kendall's brief, it talks about the fiscal responsibilities at two different places. It references how this is an important fiscal event for his client. And I would like to emphasize to this court that that is not the basis for forfeiture, that they need this money to profit. Because bear in mind, none of it goes to the state fund, not one red cent. It goes to
Mr. Ventura, you're almost out of time, but I do need to ask this question because you keep telling us as a error correcting court that we need to make some case law on this. So let me ask you, what do you see us creating as a syllabus point in terms of case law?
Well, first, this should be a published decision. Second, this court should realize that look at Solem and look at the Supreme Court's analysis in Austin. The Minnesota Supreme Court didn't decide it, the U.S. Supreme Court. And then look to all the decisions that this court has had in the past. As I said, since you can't find one in which there was a decision that the fine of a vehicle, the forfeiture, was excessive. Now that Timms has come down, I think it's a watershed for us. I would have thought Bajakistan would have done it, but now Timms does. And it's an excessive penalty, and particularly in my client's case, because he was not convicted of a forfeitable offense. He was charged with one, but not convicted with one.
Mr. Ventura, thank you. Judge Warkey, any further questions?
No, thank you.
You have a sentence or two to wrap up, but your time is done, Mr. Ventura.
I won't take any more of your time. I sure appreciate the opportunity to see you all. I'm sorry that we can't be there in person.
Well, thank you very much for your arguments and your helpful briefing. The court will take this matter under advisement and a decision will be issued within 90 days. Thank you both very much.